It's a wintry day here in the mountains of Western North Carolina. Kind of overcast in the 40s. Good day to be inside. And of course, I hope you're inside too. And you probably are if you're listening to this at your computer or at your radio, somewhere in the proximity of, at any rate. I know I say all of our wordplay shows are special, but today we really do have a special show. We've got Kay Byer, Poet Laureate of North Carolina, reading at the Asheville Art Museum on the 30th of March this year. So without further ado, we'll just move straight to the reading.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Nancy, for arranging this, for having the idea to bring together Mr. Brock's photographs and my poetry. The more I look at these photographs, the more I see why, you know, understand why. I particularly love the mountains, the landscapes, and I was thinking when we were driving over here about Barry Lopez's essay on photography, Learning to See, and his obsession with trying to capture light, and how many times he tried to capture the motion of water in his photographs, and that, and this one in particular, really strikes me. I really love the movement that's captured in this photograph. He talks about also trying to capture a sense of time, and some of the photographs of particular mountains, for example, he felt that if he had not captured the sense, then several other photographers he mentioned in this essay had, and he called it capturing indigenous time, which is fascinating. You think of indigenous time that clings to the sides of mountains, the sides of rocks, and will not be hurried along by our own fast-paced modern sense of time. I just find that really mysterious and haunting. And I get a sense of that looking at these landscapes. Several of my poems, more than several actually, got started by photos that I fell in love with, photographs that I just felt calling to me in some ineffable way. And the first photographer whose work did that for me is Sharon Angling Cooney. She lived outside Asheville for a number of years before her death, and I first saw her photographs in the Arts Journal. Do any of you remember the Arts Journal from years ago? It was a wonderful publication, and I can't even remember when it stopped publication, but I was involved with that for a number of years. Sharon's photographs were of water, of mountains, of the natural world, but always with something human inserted, say a shawl or a pair of shoes or a dress, a woman's dress that would just be thrown out on the grass. And so they invited narrative. They invited your imagination to come in and make something of all of that. And I began to do that with several of her photographs and got to know Sharon, and we had really wanted to do a collaboration together, but never got around to it. So let me just begin this reading with a couple of the poems that came out of Sharon's photographs. Let's see. One of them is, and this is the title that she used, Chestnut Flat Mine. And this is a photograph of landscape, creek in the background, shawl, a woman's dress thrown out on the grass, and I just started playing around with it. They say the fringe of her shawl clung like lichen to creek rock, and under the laurel her sash looked for all the sad world like a garter snake. Farther on, something so sheer it was almost invisible floated away on the Tow River. Red, said the woman who watched it go by. Baby blue, said her little girl, stoning the water with acorns. Did he stroke her silken leg after he'd unlaced her tiny black shoe? Did he say, little darling, you're mine, and what good are your fancy ways now? God Almighty, they say they heard screams floating down, light as what I imagine a town woman wears underneath all her finery. But when they came to the old mine by late afternoon, they found only her gloves thrown aside in the larkspur. Her dress was laid out like a corpse with a rose in its lap. On its lily-white bosom, a bird's nest of wrinkles, as if a man's head had lain ever so gently there. You can read all sorts of balladry and news stories and whatever into that. I just loved the ambiguity of that photograph and how you could find so many things to write about, to spur and stir your imagination in that photograph. One of the photographs, one of my favorite Kune photographs, was of a shawl draped, let's say, I'm just going to step back here. Imagine a shawl draped across the rocks there with the fringe being carried, being stirred by the current. I was fascinated by that, and Sharon and I had talked about this particular image, particularly the shawl being a black shawl. And we had talked about trying to interweave the image of a black shawl that she was going to take some photographs of a black shawl and have this poem entitled Black Shawl woven into it some way as a poster. But we never got around to that. This poem is entitled Black Shawl, and again comes from the images in Sharon's photographs. Black shawl around me, unraveling its garland of snake root and cobweb. Her black thoughts made manifest night after night as she labored, her silver hook gleaming by candlelight. Memory chained unto memory, hawk sailing, smoke curling out of the burned fields, her name written fancy in black ink, the words in her letter, the two words, remember me. Nights I can't sleep, I hear wind shove the dead leaves along like my own thoughts. Those rag-taggled gypsies she sang about, all of them black-shawled and stealing away to their dirty work, digging as always past earthworm and groundwater, tremor of mine shaft where rocks bear, the imprint of ancient anemone. They bring her back piece by piece to me, even the sound of her breath in my oldest dream. What will you make of this, they whisper, filling my arms with a snatch of her hair, muddy ribbons, this tangle of black roots that drags my hands down. I began these poems without really knowing, or some of these poems without really knowing where they were taking me. I just knew I was haunted by the imagery in them. And it took me a while to realize that they were all part of a voice, a story that that my imagination was gathering for me in the voice of a mountain woman named Alma. And she first began to talk to me, speak to me, on a hike that I took with my husband quite some years ago out in the Smokies. It was the Mingus Mill Trail, wasn't it, Jim, that we were on? And we we climbed up, you know, took the switchback up and up the mountains, and there was a deserted home site we came upon, and I just sensed some kind of presence there, and this woman's voice began in my head. When I got back from the hike, I wrote down as much as I could and entitled the poem Wildwood Flower, because I'd fallen in love with the song Wildwood Flower, the Carter family. I'd been haunted by that song. I still don't know quite what it means, but I knew that it meant something important to me in terms of just getting the hair to stand up on my arms and, you know, the nape of my neck, feeling, oh, you know, this is good stuff. So I began this poem on the trail. I hoe thawed ground with a vengeance. Winter has left my house empty of dried beans and meat. I am hungry, and now that a few buds appear on the sycamore, I watch the road winding down this dark mountain. Not even the mule can climb without a struggle. Long daylight, and nobody comes while my husband traps rabbits, chops firewood, or walks away into the thicket. Abandoned to hoot owls and copperheads, I begin to fear sickness. I wait for pneumonia and lockjaw. Each month I brew squaw tea for pain. In the stream where I scrub my own blood from rags, I see all things flow down from me into the valley. Once I climbed the ridge to the place where the sky comes. Beyond me the mountains continued like God. Is there no place to hide from his silence? A woman must work, else she thinks too much. I hoe this earth until I think of nothing but the beans I will string, the sweet corn I will grind into meal. We must eat. I will learn to be grateful for whatever comes to me. Now, as I'm standing here, I see these landscapes that are so powerful and you know, both familiar and strange. And then I look over at the faces, particularly the face of the Cherokee woman. That's just that's an amazing photograph. The old man with the pipe. And I think what I was trying to do in these mountain poems was blend landscape and person and character, trying to take, say, the face of a woman. I was beginning to imagine and place her in a landscape that spoke to her, that spoke to me, and could function within the structure of the poem as a metaphorical framework, let's say, as a place where Alma would be able to find meanings for her own emotions, her own longings, her own dreams and losses. This poem, Empty Glass, was one of the first poems in which I began to sense something like that happening. Last night I stood ringing my empty glass under the black, empty sky and beginning of all things to sing. The mountains paid no attention. The cruel ice did not melt. But just for a moment, the hoot owl grew silent. And somewhere, the wolves hiding out in their dens opened cold, sober eyes. Here's to you, I sang, meaning the midnight, the dark moon, the empty well, meaning myself, upon whom the snow fell without any apology. Alma lived around the turn of the century in the story that I was weaving of her, so she would have been around at the same time or near the same time that these photographs were being made. And I've always thought that in the realm of the imagination, all sorts of things come together, and if Alma never really existed in real life, but in some realm of the imagination she did, and maybe was part of these photographs in some mysterious way.
Listening to Kay Stripling Byer, Catherine Stripling Byer, current poet laureate of North Carolina, reading at the Asheville Art Museum in March 2008. This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and this is WPVM 103.5 on the old dial in Asheville, North Carolina. Now let's hear a little bit more of Kay.
I will read a little while longer. I would love to have questions from you. Let me read a couple more from Wildwood Flower, and then maybe one or two from Black Shawl. Black Shawl is a bit of a spillover book collection, spillover poems from the work I was doing in Alma's voice. So I tend to think of them as continuing some of the same themes and images that I began in Wildwood Flower. This poem is a spring poem, Trillium. Soon Trillium will be out and we'll be enjoying it. And in this poem, Alma is with her lover out in her future husband out in the woods, and it's April. April and I have come far as the trails fork to whisper it. Watery sound like the swollen creek running beside us. The morning we left church and walked till he threw down his coat on the grass. How the ridges were rife with this world's blooming multitudes, sprung out of nothing and overnight, as if the souls of all creatures with wings buried under the leaf mold had risen and, but for our presence, might take to the sky singing praise. Nothing moved, neither wind nor the scurry of mice in the underbrush. Far away, I heard the blue jays rejoicing, and then his breath filling my ear with my name. Soul of sweet mercy, I should have covered my head with my shawl and kept silent. Though we spoke of love, I know now it means little but loneliness. Better if he had said, Trillium, Trillium, I might have known what he meant. Flood tide. Both of us well nigh to drowning. Oh, all this urge to be swept away, you know, by that creek water, by that wonderful light that goes on and on and on as long as the water flows. This poem is in several parts. And again, it has water in it. It's entitled Ivy Sing Ivory, and it comes from an old mountain song, Ivy Sing Ivory, Rosebud and Thorn. Like women, the dogwoods go nowhere and wait for their season, the sun coming back like a sea-roving laddie. By May Day, the ground will be white with their fare-thee-wells. No man will heed. His boots grinding a path through the leaf mold. Such pretty things, Mama said, touching the ivory lace of my wedding clothes. What good are they to me now? Every night I see stars falling, white petals into the wilderness. The church bell rings Easter all morning like clear broken ice, and beneath it the almost unmoving water. White water charges the banks after rain has been heavy. I hear it wherever I go, like the swirl of my dress as I stand up suddenly, kicking the chair from my path. Leaves rasp underfoot, half a day's climb to the summit. A possum sways four branches heavenward. Silver bells, what sweeter music than silence? The snail travels slowly toward water that's been gone for centuries, rocked by the tide song of wind sweeping leaves back and forth through the gap. Down to the grist mill, I follow the creek swollen so loud by rain, I can't hear myself sing ho a honey ho. Lady Luck's left me a buckeye to warm in my pocket all day, like an earring the old woman pulled from her dirty pack, whispering, filigree. Gypsies, my mama said, pointing me back to the crochet hook stuck in a tangle of tiny white stitches. It's too hard, I cried, throwing down all my fancy work. Fast as I could, I set out for the top of Bald Ridge, asking why can't I keep walking out of this endless blue sky into somebody else's life. Fiddles and red skirt that tickles the floorboards till dawn. But I knew I could never go far from the sound of this creek tumbling down to the lilies of Cullowhee Valley that bloom like a garland of lace on my doorsill. Oh, ivy, sing ivory, rosebud and thorn. If only this afternoon really were endless alongside the gay Tuckasegee, where now I ask, watching its broken light leaving me, why can't this water run smooth as stone? Why can't this water be captured like that photograph and held forever? Let me shift to another set of photographs. Let me read a wild poem here. This has wolves in it again. I've always liked wolves. You know, we don't have them anymore around here. It ought to have wolves in it. Yeah, it does have a wolf in it. It's about the moon and a basin of water and a woman wanting to go out and have a wild time. It's called She. This is from Black Shawl. Caught in my basin, the moon shimmies. She must feel low down tonight, floating there like some big city showgirl silk underwear, daring me stir up her lather and scrub till I'm crazy with moonshine, the better to see my way clear through the thick of my mama's keep, thirsty for what makes my teeth ache. This summer I've nothing to dream on but dirt roads, my mouth full of singing that swells like the creek jumping bank at the pull of the honky-tonk season. I'm game to go prowling the backwoods with every bitch loosed for a dozen miles, howling at first sight of her rising over the pine scrub of Hell's Thicket, where in the last eyes of wolf I hear tell of, she still burns closing in for the kill. Well, there you've got Diana, I suppose, and the wolf, and who knows what else out there doing some hunting in the moonlight and calling this young girl out to have some fun with them. After Sharon died, I was reading in Chapel Hill with Lee Smith, and I happened to mention in my comments that I had hoped to do a collaboration with a photographer. Sharon was originally from Kentucky. And afterward, a very tall woman came up to me, and very obviously she had to be an artist. I mean, she had on tights and a lot of purple and shawl, you know, things like that. And she said, well, I'm a photographer and I'm from Kentucky. Why don't we do a collaboration together? Her name was Lou Ann Wadley. And she had been doing, she had been a weaver for one thing, and a very fine weaver, but she had moved on over into photography and had been doing a study of a woman in her 80s by the name of Betty Bell. She had taken these wonderful black and white photographs of Betty and wanted to show them to me. They were part of a project that she called The Ashes of Beauty. Betty had been a gorgeous woman and was still beautiful in her old age, and she wished to be called Evelyn, not Betty. Betty was too ordinary for her. She wanted to be extraordinary. For some reason, she thought Evelyn, well, she was just taken with Evelyn, as she told Lou Ann, like Evelyn Waugh. So, I mean, and she was literary. She read a lot. She hung out in Chapel Hill bookstores, and there's one photograph of her with her hat on and numerous bangles and what looks like a feather boa. I mean, she was well known in the Chapel Hill area. She was quite a character. She had come back from New York City, where she'd been an artist model for a number of years, and began living in the family home place outside Chapel Hill. So Lou Ann began documenting her last years, and they're fantastic, fabulous photographs. And I was much taken with these photographs and thought, well, gee, let's see what I can do with them. Lou Ann brought them to City Lights bookstore in Silva, and I took my notebook and just roamed from photograph to photograph, seeing if I could pick up any voice from them, any images, and did. And the nucleus of those poems became Catching Light, which is, fourth book. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The first few poems in the book are taken from that afternoon when I stood there in the gallery of City Lights bookstore and began writing in my notebook in the photograph gallery. And this is Evelyn speaking. She looks like a ghost, somebody says, staring at me walking my yard of an evening. If yard you could call it now. Honeysuckle vines running wild and the blackberries leaping from one side of dark to another. I walk among photographs wondering who it is these people think I am. Who is she, a child hanging onto her mother's skirt, asks as if she is frightened by what she sees. Just a little old lady, her mother soothes. That's all she is. So it became my plan to answer that question, or to respond to that, who is she, and then to take issue with that's all she is, just a little old lady. Number two, am I breathing, lying here on the grass with my face to the ground? Does my hand move, an ant crawl across it? A bird's feather fall? Shake me, nudge my arm, tell me to wake up and say something. Three. On my hands and knees, digging a while in what used to be garden, my back caught a moment in light, like each one of these ferns lifting out of the leaf mold. I can't see that blazing white sea swell beyond me keep coming, while here in the undertow I grip my trowel, the afternoon fading, the pool of my life growing still. Four. Even up here in the attic, enough light comes through to make holding this hoop skirt of white net I wore to the dance one more luminous moment. If I tried to dance in it now, it would tear from its ribbing, collapse. Perhaps I would trip over it, tumble into the rubble of too long a life. The daylight as seen through its netting looks dreamlike as first love. The lights on the dance floor beginning to lower. The slow dance we waited all night for about to begin. 5. How many women have sat as I see myself sit in this car going nowhere, their eyes looking out at the same small town streets or the same fields a father or husband has tilled while they inhale the odor of vinyl and motor oil, turning the radio dial through a rainbow of static till they hear a woman's voice wailing all the way down from Chicago, the same old sad sing-along, somebody done gone and left me here, night coming on. A place for everything, but how can everything stay always in one place? Are there that many places? And where is my place? In this mirror I don't want to look into? There are always around me the dead flowers curlicue over the walls as if to say, here is your only true place, the reflection you see in your own eyes. What a clutter my days have come down to, that lampshade aslant on its axis, the desk running over with letters and bills, all the pages I've ripped out of one magazine or another. I sit inside rooms spilling over with things while the sun moves across the floor, turning to light all that lies in its path as I am hair by hair kindling the whole of me waiting to go up in one burst of late afternoon torching everything. This window keeps watching me walking away through the weeds. In my old bedroom shoes, I go shuffling. Come back, I breathe onto the glass. Write my name on the curtain my breath makes a little while. Eve, Evelyn, where are you going without me? You think in the dark I am nobody. Open the door. Do you see who I am? Tell me, you who see only the back of me, how does my face look confronting the light? So that's the beginning of Catching Light, in which Evelyn confronts her images on the wall, the image of herself, her life in these photographs. And I'm sorry I don't have the photographs here with me, but I think you can pick up something of what they were. After seeing her house, the interior of her house with everything scattered around it, I thought, well, my house is not so bad. I mean, that house was really, really a mess. And everything. She would have bills, magazines, old shoes. She had several dogs, and there they'd be, you know, lounging around on whatever. There's a photograph of her in the bathtub, this ancient-looking bathroom, and here's Evelyn with her white hair. She had this long white hair, and she's sitting there in the bathtub. There is a photograph, indeed, of her feet. Well, she's in her bedroom slippers, and it's taken through the window, and there are her feet heading away, and, you know, just her feet walking away. And so I had a really good time letting these images call up a voice, call up a life, and a persona, and following that story that evolved in my imagination as far as I was able to follow. Let me read the last poem to you, and then I'll let you ask me some questions, if you will, which I hope you'll do. This is titled Open, and it's from a photograph of Evelyn leaving and looking back
at the house, at the room, and the light on the far side. Why do I turn to look back? Let the dark keep itself to itself. Let this house keep. It's not going anywhere. I am. My handbag slung over my shoulder, my left wrist aglitter with silver. This hat that a young girl might wear, why shouldn't I wear it? Why shouldn't I swing the door wide and walk out? The door on the other side's open, the day blazing through, and beyond it another way into which I might keep going or disappear. Vamanos, avanti, lightly, lightly, I sing to myself, shutting the door ever after behind me.
There lived a lady by the North Sea shore. Lay the band to the bonny broom. Two daughters were the babes she bore. Fa la 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 la. As one grew bright as is the sun, lay the band to the bonny broom. So coal black grew the elder one. Fa la 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 la. Night came riding to the lady's door. Lay the band to the bonny broom. He traveled far to be there.
This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And we're listening to a reading by Catherine Stripling Byer at the Asheville Art Museum from March of this year, 2008. After the reading, Kate took questions from the audience, and I've had to boost the levels on some of the questions because they were, you know, way in the back of the room or whatever. So it's a little bit noisy at places, but the questions were good, and so we'll listen to those too.
So, any questions from anyone? Yeah.
Maybe not with so much with Evelyn, but with Alma. Is it Alma?
Alma.
Girls. How much do you immerse yourself in that persona, and how do you get out of the way in order to let that kind of a persona come through? And do you walk through your days with your ear kind of half cocked?
Yeah, you do.
Is there a different process?
Yeah. You walk through your days with your ear and your ears cocked and your eyes focused. I can remember looking out the window at the trees, or, you know, looking at the garden, for example, and just beginning to see it as Alma might have seen it, and letting the language begin. And as soon as I would feel that energy, that surge of energy, and it's hard to put in words, but it's like suddenly I'm excited. You know, there's something about to happen. You know, she's looking now, and she's beginning to speak. And I got out of the way when the language began to work, and most of these poems, I revised some of them, but most of them just sort of came. You know, they were like gifts, and I learned to get out of the way and to not question them, but just let that voice say itself, and not question what it was telling me. Now, I question myself all the time with most of my other work, but with Alma, I figured she knew more than I did about the place that she was speaking from, and that's what I'd been wanting to do for so long. We'd lived in the mountains 8 years, and I had so wanted to be able to finally begin to write out of a sense of that particular place, because earlier I'd been writing poems about growing up in Southwest Georgia and dealing, working with that landscape, letting that landscape rise up through language. I wanted to have that happen with the mountains, with the trails we hiked, with, you know, with the things I heard and saw around me, with the music that I heard, stories that women who had lived in the mountains all their lives had been telling me. And I did pull those into some of the poems as well. It's like everything kind of started coming together through this particular persona, this voice. And I didn't want to question it too much. I just wanted it to happen. And to try to, and to step out of the way and just let it. And so that's about all I can really say about the process. It was a mysterious process, and it began on that trail, you know, with Wildwood Flower, with the poem Wildwood Flower. And at that time, I didn't really know who she was. It wasn't until a little bit later that I gave her the name Alma. Alma, after a neighbor woman, Miss Alma Presley, had been so generous to me. And I thought, well, I like that name. And I like what the name means, soul, spirit. She just came to represent something in the spirit of the women I had met and in the landscape itself that was important to me. I had to express itself some way. Yeah, Marita.
Can you tell me something about your new book, Coming to Rest? Is it also focused around a woman or
persona? No, in Coming to Rest, I've come back to the South Georgia, the flat coastal plain landscape, in part at least, and have revisited that landscape and some of the tensions, some of the longings and stories there. And this middle section is a sequence of travel poems that I began many, many years ago when our daughter was young, and we took several trips west, camping trips west. And one summer I decided I was setting out to search for Salt Woman, the Pueblo deity who lives and rests and sleeps in the bottom of Zuni Lake. And you have to sing her out, a call to her, and she will then come and give you water and give you salt and the savor that your life has lost. So that is what the middle section is about. Some very, very old ancient poems and very new ones in that particular sequence. Then the last section, kind of a grab bag with some politically oriented poems, some poems taking on a writer's conference, and some comments made there, and trying to have a little fun. I wanted to now and then try to be a little, well, I don't want to say bitchy, but why not? I mean, just, you know, why not run the gamut if you can? So that's pretty much what Coming to Rest is about, and it takes the title from a poem by Seamus Heaney. We come back, the birthplace is the name of the poem, we come back emptied to nourish and resist the words of coming to rest. That tension of home, being drawn to home, at the same time resisting it, and that I wanted to deal with that kind of dynamic as much as I could in that particular collection.
Do you revise your work much, and do you get much feedback on your work as you go along?
I used to get a lot of feedback. I went through the MFA program at UNC Greensboro and workshopped, for 2 years there, and had a number of friends I would send work to and tried to be as eagle-eyed as I possibly could about my work. I put my early work through a lot of revision. It was hard work. I mean, it was like wrestling, with the language, with a poem sitting there at my table and just really waiting and fiddling with the syntax, with word choice, with just whatever I could do, just playing with language in a very serious way. And I guess you could say it was playing with me, too. Lately, in the past several years, I've not shown my work around as much. I've not sent it to people to critique. I still revise a lot, and I love to revise. I mean, I think revision is very satisfying. The Alma poems were different, and they just came, and that was great, wow. And it was so much fun, and I felt I could ride this particular creek forever, and you know, see how far it carried me. But Alma stopped after a while. You know, I had to go back and start really, really working hard on my poetry, and it's just not something that comes easily to me. I mean, the initial impulse, the initial imagery and rhythm, there it is, and it's exciting, but so often it's a way to have you start plumbing the depths of your emotions, your imagination, and it can take a good while before you have that poem in the shape that you feel is worthy of the initial impulse that began it. You know, that you remain true to that rhythm, to that metaphor, that particular whatever you want to call it that starts a poem. So it's a pleasure of taking pains, and you know, I enjoy revision a lot. I do. Yeah, Nancy, that's you.
I know that you, as a poet laureate, have been traveling a lot and doing these, you know, you just got back from Charlotte for a multi-day thing. So I'm wondering, how do you balance those demands on your time with your...
I don't do that very well at all. One of the pleasures and advantages, I haven't been working a whole lot on my own work actually over the past 3 years, but I have been made to work on poetry through occasional poems, being asked to write poems for this or that, and then really getting into it and feeling that I found something of my own work through being required to write poems for the North Carolina Manual, for example, or the North Carolina Library Association, and you know, just and beginning to realize that the imagery, the material that I've gathered over these various decades of my life, can be taken then and put into these poems so that I then have a personal stake in them. You know, they become mine in a way they might not have otherwise. And I've really, really enjoyed that. Let me read one that was more or less required of me. it was not required, it was invited. But Margot Flood over at Warren Wilson College invited me to write a poem for their Heartstone, their yearly Heartstone issue. God, how am I going to do this? You know, I don't really have the time, but Margot's so nice, and she really wants me to do this, and I really ought to try to do this. I'd like to do this. So I usually begin on a piece of paper or in a notebook with a ballpoint pen, but this time I just sat down with my laptop and started working. And oh man, I have some, I don't know how many drafts of this particular poem, and it took me a good while to. It took me several nights, to say the very least, of sitting there staring at that laptop screen and just redoing and fiddling and playing. I was using as my epigraph, a quote from Adrienne Rich: "The tests I need to pass are prescribed by the spirits of place who understand travel but not amnesia." I wanted to speak to the importance of remembering where we come from and remembering where we are. And given the age that I've become, you know, I started worrying about not being able to remember names so well anymore, forgetting things. I can never find my glasses, for example. If I take them off, I might as well, you know, I will spend at least 30 minutes looking for them. My keys, my anything, you know, my memory was really beginning to bother. The poem begins with that, and that concern. The title of the poem is Last Light, and it's in four sections. And it seems like a good way to conclude. almost the age when memory falters. I fear being made to count backward by sevens, to answer to date, year, and presidents, as if those numbers and names matter more in the end than this place where I stand at the same kitchen window, observing the same pines set swaying by wind, reaching upward as I'll reach come morning, my arms to the ceiling, breathing the dark out of body and spirit, exhaling that old dream of nothingness, laying my head down to sleep. Now Rocky Face Ridge catches fire in the last light, and though I can't hear it from where I stand, Cullowhee Creek tumbles into the Tuckasegee, always unscrolling beneath me the names I already know. Snowbird, Buzzard's Roost, Weyahutta, Oconaluftee. I don't know how long names can last if there's no one to care where they live. What I saw on the hairpin curve down from the chimney tops white as snow, I've not forgotten. Facelia. And how, on the trail leading up to the summit of Suncota Ridge, I saw sauntering toward me a young woman I could have sworn was the reincarnation of every spring wildflower ever named anywhere. Closer she comes to me each April, as if she means more than I have a lifetime to know. Round about her, her white Easter dress whispers everything thing I want to keep living here in this valley that cups the last swallow of light. Every name I must reach to remember or else lose them hillside by hillside to darkness. So thank you for listening, and remember to remember the names of the things you love and the places you love, so maybe they won't be gobbled up and destroyed by the bulldozers coming at us from every direction. Yeah. Got one question.
Do you notice a difference in your own experience while writing a poem between using a laptop and your hand? And do you think in some way it affects the poem itself?
I think it can definitely affect the poem itself. And I know that I have to be careful not to be too easily satisfied by the poem as I'm working on my laptop, because it can look pretty good. It can look really good. And sometimes it ain't all that good. I mean, you just have to be careful. And another way I find working on the laptop with these occasional poems very helpful, because it enables me to get something down and to feel that I am doing that assignment. You know, that I have finally got stuff. I mean, the empty page is scary, and so is the empty, computer screen. And as soon as I can get something down and feel that I'm working toward that assignment for the occasional poem, I feel a lot better, and that loosens me up a bit. But, yeah, it's just a different process, too. I mean, it's just the hand moving across the page. It's just different from sitting there typing and having your gaze focused on the words appearing there. Yeah. Yeah, it is at a remove. It's less, there's less body involved in it. It's less, even though you're typing, but it's just not as palpable. I don't feel the movement of language in the way I do when I'm writing on a page. And that's why I think most of my poems will continue to be begun, if not finished, on a page. I mean, I've begun poems on the back of Walmart receipts. I began a poem that I ended up really loving and I'm quite proud of on the back of a Walmart receipt, because the idea came to me as I was driving. And so I hastily scribbled, and, sometimes I'll even start writing on my arm, you know, if I can't find a piece of paper. Just something to capture that moment, that first moment of energy and excitement when the connections, the connections start firing there. That's a good question, though. I've worried about myself. Oh, you're going to end up being a computer writing poet, and I just really, I can handle it though. I think, you know, but there is a difference for sure. Yeah.
Paula, do you save your drafts when you go through?
Oh Lord, no, no. Well, some I do. Yeah, I started doing that because, you know, the nice thing about writing on paper. Or is it such a nice thing if you've got stacks and boxes of paper? But, you know, you do have everything, and there could be a portion of a poem that a year or two later you pull out and say, wow, I can really do something with this. If you don't save it on your laptop, then it's gone. So I've been trying to save my drafts on my computer. So I've got lots of stuff on my computer now. Hard drive, so yeah, it's good to save. But after at my age, I've saved so much that I'm thinking it's time to throw some of it out. Spring cleaning is in order, definitely, in my office. Thank y'all so much. You've been great.
And that's a reading by Catherine Stripling Meyer at the Eschel Art Museum in March of 2008. This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Tune in again next week for another new and special show. This is WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains. And you can check out the old blog at naturespoetry.blogspot.com for more information about today's show.
Because